of all, welcome everybody. Welcome to New York. I, like you, am from Los Angeles, born and raised. Is everybody? Where does everybody go to school? Everybody's currently
UCLA.
One place. UCLA.
Yeah,
everyone,
graduated.
I was there myself.
Everyone important is at UCLA.
UCLA, yeah. Everybody.
Everybody had a big fan. Everyone else.
I was 2 semesters at UCLA before I transferred to New York. I was at I took a screenplay and I took world history, and then I came to New York. So I love you. I mean, no campus here, I have to say, compares to what you have at UCLA, and I'm sure the weather already is making you freak out, but I don't know, for some reason we all these people ended up in New York, and I can't, every time I go back to LA, I can't figure out why. There's a ton of energy here, and you're going to enjoy it. It's a lot of fun for those. I've got a couple people who've been here for the first time to New York, so that definitely is exciting. And how long are you here for?
A week.
2 weeks. Nice. Okay. All right, so the topic I said I would speak about was the topic of a breakthrough. And this topic is something that, I don't know if anybody saw, the new book just came out. It's a crazy book. It's really crazy. I don't know if you've ever seen the 4-Hour Work Week. It came out a few years ago. So it teaches you how to get everything done in the most minimal amount of time. 4-Hour Work Week. Really, it teaches you all these tricks, how to crunch everything down. You're studying, your job, everything, so you can live most of your life in vacation mode. This guy just came out with a new book called The 4-Hour Body, okay? So where he crunches down, I haven't done it yet, but we'll see. The 4-Hour Body, and it teaches you all these things of how to be, you know, how to, every diet, crunching it down to 4 hours. Anything at the 4 hours. It's wild. The idea is he's put himself through, he's a human guinea pig, this guy, Timothy Ferris. He's put himself, you know, he, for example, one theory is why Michael Phelps needs to consume a crazy amount of calories per day, the swimmer Michael Phelps. And it doesn't add up, because you look at the amount of calories he burns through swimming, the amount of calories he takes in, according to him and his trainer, there's something off. He's taking in a lot more than he seems to be burning. So this guy's theory, Timothy Ferris's theory, is that it's the cold water. So he submerged himself while dieting in cold water, meaning he took a cold bath every morning and a cold shower at night and wanted to see if that would excel, that would create rapid weight loss. And he found that his numbers were flying much faster than they were on a regular system. How did I get into Timothy Ferris? I don't remember where I was getting at, but the point is that, yes, in Manhattan, I don't know if this is where I started with, but in Manhattan, everybody's doing things here much quicker, finding ways to crunch everything down. Yes, breakthrough, that's how I got here. So we're all looking for some breakthrough in our lives, some way to make life easier, some way to make life more exciting, more meaningful, more manageable, and at the same time to give you a knockout experience. And I, for the past 10, 12 years, just been trying to, I'm a system collector. I try to collect different systems and to try to put something together that would actually one day, you know, allow us to make a breakthrough in the easiest way possible. And what I noticed along that journey is that every system that I've been looking at has already been a variation of a system that's out there. Whether you're looking at Eckhart Tolle, I don't know if anybody read Eckhart Tolle's The Power of Now or A New Earth, his concepts of presence and being there right in the moment, those have always been there. That truth has always been there. So any self-help book you would get, I've read almost all of them, every single one. I'm a self-help junkie, and my claim is that every idea that's being espoused now in those books has already been there, and it's been there very much so in our tradition, not just between the lines, overtly staring us in the face. So I set out, as I said, to this goal of trying to create some sort of breakthrough system. And I'm sharing with you just the beginning stages of these thoughts. And you could try this out. You could take any area of your life that you're looking for a breakthrough in, and you could try some of this stuff out on. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't, I'd love to hear your feedback. So this notion of a breakthrough, let's take a step back. Who says that we can have a breakthrough? Who says we're capable of that? There must be a bunch of areas of our lives where we're not destined to excel at or be good at. So there's a statement by one of the great philosophers and rabbis. His name was Maimonides. He said that every single person could be as great as Moses. Every single human being could be as great as Moses. Now, that's a bold statement, because Moses is definitely, if you were to make a list of the top 10 figures in the entire Jewish tradition, he's up there in the top 3, arguably top 2, maybe top 1, but he's there in the top 3. So if you're saying everyone has the potential to be like Moses, the man who spoke directly to God, received the Torah, then that's a bold statement. It means that we have within each of us the capability of excellence and mastery. If we have that within each of us, it means that we are capable and we each deserve a breakthrough when we want it to happen. But maybe you'll say, wait a second, yes, we can be, but it's a lifetime of work. And we're children of an ADD nation, and that means we want answers now. We don't have our whole lives to wait for a breakthrough. I don't want a breakthrough at 75. I want that breakthrough now. And the answer is that God is telling us that breakthroughs can happen in a moment. For example, I noticed that right before, you know, the Jewish New Year, Rosh Hashanah, I noticed that the prayer 5 minutes before the New Year starts, which is the same prayer that one would say every day, three times a day, says in there a blessing, God should bless this year, past tense. God should bless the year you're in. Let's say 2010, God should bless this year. And I was wondering, why in the world would I still say this blessing if there's 2 minutes left in the year? There's 2 minutes. I'm about to start the new year. The Jewish New Year is going to start in 2 minutes. Maybe I should leave this blessing out. It's too late. The year's over. And I heard a beautiful response. The response was given by a Hasidic Rebbe, and he said the following answer. He said, Yeshuas Hashem keheref ayin. What that means in English is God can change things in the blink of an eye. Breakthroughs are for all of us. In any which way of our lives, we deserve a breakthrough. We are capable of a breakthrough. And those breakthroughs may take us a little bit of time, but they can. Change can happen in an instant. Now, it needs work to follow up with that change, but the breakthrough in your life, the trigger that says, I'm going to change something right now, or that aha moment, as Oprah calls it, that could happen right away. That could happen in a heartbeat. And it happens to people all the time. I'll sit as a rabbi of a synagogue, I'll meet with couples, I'll meet with people sometimes struggling in their lives, and I'm meeting with more people now because as you know, the financial world gets tougher and tougher, you meet more couples having a tougher time, trying to make ends meet, and it creates a lot of stress. And suddenly, there's breakthroughs in their lives. When they just come to realize one or two things, breakthroughs happen. And that's the idea. We deserve a breakthrough, and breakthroughs can happen instantaneously. When should we make that breakthrough? When should we make that breakthrough? So there's a great question. The question was raised in the 15th century by a Spanish Jewish writer. Someone came to him in a real-time question. Somebody sent the letter to him. I have fallen in the good graces of my prison warden. And at that time, there was, as often in Jewish history, tremendous amount of anti-Semitism. It was around the time of the Spanish Inquisition, and many times Jews who did not convert to Christianity would have been locked away. And one Jew got close with the prison warden, and the prison warden offered the Jew one day to leave prison, one day to go pray. I'll let you out one day, you can go with your other people, go find a place to pray, and I'm throwing you back in. So he sent a letter to this rabbi, this 15th century rabbi named the Radbaz, Rabbi David Ben Zimra. And he sent him a letter and he asked him, what day should I choose? If I'm allowed any one day, what day should I choose? And this rabbi in this letter is going back and forth in his mind. Should I tell him the holiest day of the Jewish year, Yom Kippur, which is the holiest? Or should I tell him the happiest day of the Jewish year, which is the holiday of Purim, which is a day of joy, of dressing up in costumes and a little bit of drinking? Maybe he needs a happy day to be out and be with his people. What day should I tell him? And he goes back and forth. And finally, at the end, he stops and says, you know what? Today. Today. The chance to have the opportunity to be with your people, to stand together with your people, the empowering feeling that he is not alone in this, that breakthrough moment he can have cannot wait. It can happen and needs to happen today. And that's the answer he sent back. None of the Jewish holidays, not the birthdays. Let him come out on that day and let him share a prayer with his people. And that tells me that one, not only are we all capable of a breakthrough. Number two, not only can it happen in the blink of an eye, but number three, we deserve it right now. At this moment, we can do the breakthrough. At this moment, we can make magnificent and significant changes in every area that we choose in our lives, in every area. So I spent 2 weeks ago, one of the greatest experiences. I walked on fire at midnight in Secaucus, New Jersey. Secaucus, New Jersey is the equivalent of, I would say in California, those cities right around, you know, like the Mojave Desert, like just nothing. Secaucus, New Jersey is just industrial, nothing doing there. But there's a convention center there, and I don't know if you ever heard of the self-help guru, Tony Robbins. You see him, I mean, late night infomercials and whatnot. So I told you I'm a self-help chaser. So I went to the Tony Robbins thing. I went in skeptical, you know, because I had heard a lot of his stuff already, read it, so I knew a lot of it. And it was, I have to say, it was amazing. If anybody has the opportunity to do it, the material is separate from the energy that he gives off. This man went from 11 a.m. to midnight without a break. He didn't walk out once to go to the bathroom. Not once. He didn't walk out for a lunch, a dinner. He just had a sports bottle, a drink, and that's it the whole time. Man's a machine. Midnight, though, he had all of us walking on fire. What's the point? I guess the point is to teach you that what you think are your limitations are not really your limitations, and you're capable of tremendous success in your life. And it was an amazing feeling. I can't even convey the way it felt. I can just tell you that it was exhilarating. Be it as it may, he was onto this idea as well that breakthroughs shouldn't take a lifetime. But he raised the following. He said there are three questions we should be asking ourselves before trying to make that change in our lives, before taking that next step. Things that I guess get in the way of our breakthroughs. Number one, what is it that stops us from moving forward? Whatever area, if it's an idea we've had as far as a direction we want to take, as far as our major, or if it's as far as a business or career opportunity that we were thinking of going, or if it's as far as a relationship we're currently in, whether it's a family member or whether it's a boyfriend, girlfriend, what is it that's stopping us from moving forward, from giving our best? Number two, the second question, what controls and determines the quality of our lives? What right now is controlling and determining the quality of my life? And number three, why do we do what we do? What drives us? That's the critical question. What is it that's driving us? We all, whether we're rebelling from parents, whether we think we're nothing like our parents, many times our family is driving us. We're either driving because we're running, or we're driving because we're like them. But in some way or another, the people around us and the people that we were there with when we were young, even if we don't like them and even if we do like them, are driving our current behaviors. So we have to ask, what is it that is driving us? These are three questions, he says, that stand in the way of any decent breakthrough. And I think they're important to note them because they do allow us the initial window or the trigger, if you will, to begin this process of a breakthrough. So take us a little different direction. We all come here with a certain way that we view the world or the way we expect our lives to be. We have a certain understanding in the way that life is supposed to go. Those are called our set of beliefs, okay? Our belief system. Separate from religion, and that's one belief system, but we have belief systems as to the way I'm supposed to enjoy life. It's supposed to be that I do X and Y is supposed to happen. It's supposed to be that I go through these courses and I'm supposed to get this job. We each have a belief system that's been programmed into our heads because of our experiences. But how many times do we stop and ask ourselves, what is our belief system and how is it defining our lives? In every single way, you'd be surprised when you do this with a paper and you map it out and you ask yourself, my decisions are coming from where? What do I believe about happiness? What do I believe about pleasure? My beliefs of helping others, where do I get them from and why do I do them? How far do I go? Where do my beliefs come from? Do they come from someone I've watched who inspired me? Where do my beliefs come from? Those beliefs are the blueprint of your life. If you understand what your beliefs are, you could basically predict the directions you're going to keep going and the decisions you're going to make each time. Meaning, if you put into a computer, these are my beliefs, and you were honest with yourself, the computer could predict, when you're faced with any decision, which way you're going to go. I'll give you an example. This is a fabulous example. This comes from the book 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey. Now it was bumped. It was number 2. It's now bumped to the 3rd highest selling self-help book of all time. Number 2 is The Purpose Driven Life by Rick Warren. And anybody know what number 1 is? Highest selling self-help book of all time. It's the Bible. Bible's number 1 highest self-help book of all time. So in 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, Stephen Covey says, look how beliefs affect your decisions. Okay? Imagine your friend says, I want you to come with me tonight. We got a great party going on. Come with me. Your teacher says, if this paper's not due tomorrow, I'm giving you the C. Okay, so your teacher's telling you the paper. Your friend's telling you the party. Your parents say, I expect you back home. Tomorrow is Megan's play over at the school. I expect you back home. You're being pulled in the 3rd way. You love just to sleep. You're being pulled in the 4th way. So now, Imagine that magnified by 9 or 10 other things. People pulling you, friends telling you this, that, every different direction. Your employer, if you work on the side, needs you to do the pizza shop that night for a couple minutes. He's short one person. Now, how do you make your decision as to what you're going to do? What standard do you use to make your decision? Well, it's all going to depend on your belief system. If you're someone who believes that you need to excel at the work that you do, then you're going to do whatever it takes to please your boss. If you believe that you need to do whatever it takes to please your boyfriend or girlfriend, then that's the way you're going to make your decision. If you're someone who believes that friends above all or partying is everything in life, then your decision's going to go that way. Whatever you believe will affect your decisions. And you know what? You're going to set yourself up for a lot of failure, because many times those decisions cause a lot of pain and hurt all the way around. And what Covey argues for is what Judas has been arguing for a long time, is that your decisions need to come from a value center. You can't make it on the whim. You can't make it subjective based on just, I prefer this, I prefer that, because you're going to end up burnt and hurt. Let's say the party path. If you choose the party path, that's great. But the problem is, you lose the grade, you take off the family, you take off the boyfriend, girlfriend, and at the end of the day, after the party experience is over, what are you left with? So you have to make sure that your decisions come from a central place where your values are. Now, your values or beliefs may be that having a great party is important to my well-being, then fine, that's your value. But as long as you're consistent as to what my value system is, by which I make all my decisions, what is the value central of my belief system, then you're good to go. The problem with that is it's so subjective. Because if you were around in Nazi Germany, the belief system for the average person in Germany was that being quiet and allowing Jews to be rounded up, that's the right thing to do right now for our society to run well, for our country to run well. That's a dangerous belief that many people held. To see that it was actually a belief held by a majority of the country, there's a book called Hitler's Willing Executioners. Very scary book. It poured out a lot of recent research that showed this was not the work of a small little group of people. It's humans just being, which is a very frightening thing. But that's not for today. It's not for a pizza shop. Next. So what our beliefs are drive our behaviors. So once we've determined that, what are we doing again? We're trying to figure out, we figured out we deserve a breakthrough. We know the breakthrough can happen now, and we know that it's possible and capable for each of us. We don't have to wait a lifetime. After we did that, we said, what drives, we have three questions you have to ask yourself before making that breakthrough. After that, we said, okay, so then what are our values? What are our beliefs? Because those beliefs are the things which get in the way of a breakthrough. Now, let's say you're in a relationship, and you believe, okay? You believe the way a relationship is supposed to work is whatever the other person says to me, I am a yes person. Yes, yes, yes. And you begin to lose you, 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 and you. But the problem is that's the kind of pattern you've seen in your own home, or that's the kind of pattern you've seen from your friends, or for whatever reason, that's the belief you've adopted. How do you make a breakthrough and change a belief? How do you alter that? How do you sort of deflect those beliefs that have been guiding your decisions all those years? How does one change a belief? You don't just say, I'm going to read something and I'll change my mind. So it seems from the bit of research I've been doing that there is three key components to shifting and altering our beliefs in a significant and strong way. These three forces impact our belief more than anything else. The first one is our physiology. Physiology means the way we move, the way we use our body. Simple as that. It sounds very physical. We're thinking the answer is going to be very philosophical, how to change a belief. Read the most spiritual. No, it's physical. It's a very physical thing. Our physiology impacts our emotion. When you wake up jumping out of bed, fired up, throwing those fists in the air, it's different than when you wake up slow, groggy, lethargic, lackadaisical. Okay? If you charge yourself up before going out with somebody, you really charge yourself up, you're a different person when you go out there. As fleeting and as physical as it sounds, we are creatures of the physical body. It affects us. It impacts us. There's a concept that's mentioned in the Jewish sources that why do we have so many commandments relating to the Jews leaving Egypt? There's over 15 commandments relating to the Jews leaving Egypt. Why so many? So one of the great writers who comments on the commandments says the reason is because the emotions follow after the physical practice. Your physical actions will draw in the emotions. And the only way to emotionally connect with the experience of the Jews leaving that point in time, freeing themselves from the shackles, that feeling can only be felt by going through a rigorous experience of physical action. That's why Judaism emphasizes what's called mitzvah, practice. Some religions emphasize just believe and you're fine. Believe, believe, believe. Judaism says the emotions are not enough. Emotion is integral to Judaism. It's half the battle. But there is a physical component that awakens the emotions. Without it, it passes. It's fleeting. The physical is what draws you in. Our physiology shapes our beliefs. I remember before the Tony Robbins was doing a little of this. I noticed before he had us walk on fire, he told all of us to pick an inspiring pose. It could be like one of these, you know. It could be screaming at ourselves, whatever it is. What he was basically doing was that same idea, that the physiology impacts upon our emotions. And you could try this out. There are practices, you could do this in an instant. You could make yourself so depressed in a heartbeat by putting on a sad face, thinking and conjuring and sort of, or speaking, using words, you know, let's stick with physical right now, but putting on a sad face, sitting lethargic, sitting depressed in a corner, you could put yourself in a negative state, I think, within minutes. Some people are so depressed they could do this within seconds. They can take themselves and just totally plunge themselves. And once you understand how physiology, you know, impacts you, you actually can learn how to pull yourself out through your physiology, even if you're not feeling a certain way. Let's say inside you just don't feel that way today. You got someone who walks in the room, couldn't be more annoying. They're sunny, they're cheery, they're jumping up and down, and you don't feel that way today. But you can make yourself feel that way today. If that's what today needs, if today needs you to be on your A game, you can make yourself feel that way. You can alter your beliefs literally through your physiology. You can change everything, there's something called the Stockholm Syndrome. You ever heard of Stockholm Syndrome? So this came up in the Elizabeth Smart case, where she was beaten by her, she was held captive by, you know, that Mormon fanatic. And she was, they asked her why she never ran away, because she had opportunities to run away. She was a little girl, and she had opportunities to run away, and she didn't even scream out, and they asked her why. And what emerged was that Stockholm Syndrome. What happens is, after you're beaten on so long, or treated in a certain way by the person holding you in captivity, you feel like you can't move, even when there's nothing in front of you. That's the reverse way that physiology impacts our emotions. There was nobody there at the time. Half the time they trusted to leave her by herself, even in public, and she couldn't do a single thing because of this Stockholm Syndrome. You know, Stockholm Syndrome is the reverse of it. You know, in the Torah portions that we read about right now, we read about how all these plagues happened in Egypt to destroy the Egyptians. And one prominent rabbi asks, why did God have to do all these things to the Egyptians? Just hit the pause button and let the Jews run out of Egypt. Let the Jews run out of Egypt, and enough, you know, done. They got to go through 10 plagues, the tremendous amount of suffering. Is that what we're promoting? So he answered as follows. This is 700 years before we knew anything about Stockholm Syndrome. He says, if the Jews would have left then with the pause button theory, forever in our lives, we would have looked back thinking, I can't move. I owe these people. I'm still connected to them. Why would we still be connected to them? Because that's Stockholm Syndrome. You as the captive are associating with your captor, so you are immobile. That's why on the Passover night, one of the things we say on Passover night is that if God had not taken us out of Egypt, we still would have been slaves to Pharaoh. What does that mean? Does not even the entire Egyptian kingdom as we know it is gone. You know, it's relegated to antiquity. It's no longer there. So, I pause for a second. Let me finish the thought, then I'll go back. So the idea is, because we still would have had that mentality in our DNA. We would have had that mentality in our heads, that Stockholm Syndrome mentality. And the way to defeat that Stockholm Syndrome is to see the destruction and the crushing of your captors. That's why some therapists will burn pictures of people's of those who abuse people, to see the humiliation, so to speak. If someone's interested in a week-long therapy process in California, it's called the Hoffman process. People pay thousands to go to this thing. At Hoffman, they teach you that everything negative in your life comes from, you know, probably your parents or something. And what they do is at the end is you take a pillow that symbolizes the person you think you got most of your negative patterns from, and you beat the garbage out of the thing. Now, that's the anti-Stockholm. That's the idea of undoing where the negative pattern. It doesn't end with that, by the way. The day after, they show you that your parents also got their issues from the people before them, and it's not your parents' fault. Forgive, beat the pillow, forgive them, and move on. I just saved you guys $6,000. Now, the Egyptian thing, which one has something very cool. The Egyptian thing, I always wonder the following question. I got my answer. This answer came from Dr. I don't know if he still teaches, a history professor at UCLA, Dr. Cleve Brown. The issue is that if you look in Genesis, Pharaoh says to Abraham, you know, when he takes Abraham's wife captive, he's like, why didn't you tell me she's your wife and that you have God? I would have let you go. I would have let her go. I wouldn't have held her captive. You should have just been open and honest with me. Then you have the Pharaoh in the classic story of Egypt, and the Jews stuck in Egypt over there. And that Pharaoh, when they say, you know, our God says, let our people go. No, no, I will not let these people go. And Pharaoh says, no way. He's not accepting of another God. So I raised that issue to Cleve Brown, because I'm learning ancient Egyptian history. And I said, any good thoughts on that? Why the Pharaoh initially, the older Pharaoh, was able to accept Abraham's concept of a God, while the other Pharaoh was not? So he said chronologically, there are actually in history two strands of theory as to what is the timeline matching that in the Bible of the different pharaohs. According to one strand, it works out perfectly. The one in the time of Abraham would have been the typical pharaoh who was a polytheistic pharaoh. Almost all the pharaohs believed in many gods. So if Abraham comes and says, I got a God, he could say, I know your God. He's a good guy. I got mine. You have yours. I would have let your wife go. It's no issue. There was one pharaoh in all of history, Amenhotep, who believed in one god, the sun god, Akhenaten. So if the Jews or Moses comes to that pharaoh and says, let my people go, I have a god, that pharaoh is not able to accept any other gods. Because you understand, he was a monotheist. He had his own god. He will not accept a second god, a Hebrew god as well, and therefore rejects the offer. And that works out perfectly timeline-wise, that the other pharaoh was a typical pharaoh, while this was the Amenhotep. Amenhotep believed in one god, by the way, Akhenaten, which was the sun god. Which, by the way, one of the classic plagues was darkness, which would be a great parallel to the Egyptian belief of the sun being the power of everything. Okay, let's get out of that for a while. Now, fine. So physiology is the first thing that allows us to alter our beliefs. Physiology is the first thing that... What time are we going to, by the way?
I believe 11 o'clock.
Fabulous.
Late. Okay. How long?
You tell me. Anytime. We're good. 11:05. Good?
Sure.
Perfect. Great. Fine. So physiology is the first thing that affects our belief. The second thing that affects our belief is what we choose to focus on. What we choose to focus on. We're the ones who make the decisions what to focus on. You ever notice the things that stress us out in our lives are the things that we're talking about over and over and over and over? We've made a choice to focus on that. Let's say there's a terrible person around us, just a narcissist. It's not them who's the problem. It's us who choose to focus on the problem. Richard Carlson has wrote some amazing books on relationship therapy. This is a good, save this one in your pocket for a rainy, for when you're married, this one's a pearl, my friends. Most people think problems in marriage, argues Carlson, happens when someone says something that crosses the line. They say something very sharp and biting or mean-spirited. Well, they've said something so hurtful they've broken this relationship. Carlson argues that the problems in relationships aren't necessarily from the statements that are said, while everybody should be careful what they say. They're in the way the other person took it. Meaning, the other person could have said, where is this statement coming from? That person's in a dark mood right now. That person's in a low place, and it's affecting their judgment. So many relationship problems happen by the other party taking the other person's statements while they're in a dark mood too seriously, taking those comments too seriously. You're choosing to harp and focus on that mistake, on that trespass. Now, that person has to apologize. It's not freeing anybody from guilt, but what it's saying is really a powerful idea. It's how and what we choose to focus on that creates most of our beliefs. We choose to focus on we dedicate a certain area of our lives to X or Y, and because of that, that alters everything we do. That alters everything. Who we choose as a friend, what we end up doing with our lives, what we end up doing as far as what we think is moral and right and correct. It's all based on focus. We focus on one single person and use that person as the example for everything we want to do in our life. And sometimes that might be altering as far as what we believe. In Judaism, there's something called kavana. Kavana means that when you pray, you have a certain focus. Prayer without focus is soulless. You don't feel anything because your mind is on nothing. Focus. Focus alters your belief, alters the way you operate, alters the way you walk through life. If you look at the Ten Commandments, what were those Ten Commandments for? The Ten Commandments were life-changing. They were a way to refocus the people who had spent all these years living in a pagan culture. History, way before the Jews, had believed in a pagan belief system. A system of, you know, throwing your kids into the fire was a form of idolatry, was a pagan custom that you would offer. Many, many prehistoric religions have this documented, that you offer one of your children to the gods, so to speak. That's a pagan concept. It's a very pagan concept. Here come this new idea, this revolutionary idea. By the way, a great book I recommend for us. It's called Thomas Cahill is the author, C-A-H-I-L-L. It's called The Gift of the Jews. It's the contribution of Judaism's message to the world. And sometimes we forget our unique message. It's very important to hear what our unique message is as stated by somebody who's not Jewish and barely knows any Jews. And therefore, it's a significant piece of work. The third area that affects our belief. Number one, we said physiology. So if you want to alter your beliefs, okay, you get up in that morning, you get fired up. I believe this morning is going to be a groggy day. Number one, your physiology. You get there in the bathroom, you lock the door when your roommate's not listening, and you scream in the mirror and you fire yourself up. Changes your morning. Or you take a cold cup of water, freezing cold, stick 10 ice cubes in there, chug the whole water, jump up and down 10 times, and you're fired up. You're ready to go. Brain freeze, but it'll pass. Number two is what you choose to focus on. Ask yourself in the morning. Morning meditation is awesome. When you get up in the morning, you ask yourself, what am I going to focus on today? What are the three or four things I'm going to try to focus on today? What's going to be my mission, my goal to make today an amazing day? Don't go into your day haphazard. Let life happen to me. Let you happen to life. You make the decisions of what happens in your day in, day out. Decide what you're going to focus on that day. The third factor is the language we use. The language we use. The way we speak. By the way, that's comedian's greatest tool is the ability to curse. The ability to use a curse word when you're angry is just, you see the difference in using it versus not using it. Language is a game changer. Language is so powerful in shifting beliefs. The way we talk over and over impacts the way we believe. If I tell myself every day that I'm worthless, if I tell myself that who needs me to stand out from the crowd, I will believe that. There is no doubt that I will believe that. If I wake up each day, and I know this sounds as corny as self-help comes, I am beautiful, I am worthy to be loved, yada, yada, yada. It has an impact. It has an impact. Judaism values the words, values the beauty of words. That's why Hebrew is the most beautiful language. Because you look at a word. Take the word love, for example, in Hebrew. The word love in Hebrew is ahava. You know what ahava, if you break down the word, means? Is ani hav, I give. What is love? Judaism uses its words to define the meaning of the words. Words aren't just label in Hebrew, right? Many languages use their language to label as a point of reference. I need to know what a table is, so I call it table. Does it look like a table? It doesn't necessarily, meaning what about that says table besides the fact that I call it table? I don't know, well, table comes from tablet, and then tabula rasa, and all that kind of word. But the original word, why is tablet flat? What makes tablet flat? But if you take the word ahava, love, you break it down, it's anihav, it's I give. And the words itself in Hebrew define the element that they're speaking of. It's not the only language. There are other languages that do that as well. A lot of the Japanese language, many times the way the words look are supposed to define what's going on in them. But Hebrew really stresses that throughout its language, that you have to understand the word, not just what the words mean. That's why it's a far cry from taking a Rosetta Hebrew Stone course, as opposed to really understanding internally what the language of Hebrew is driving at and getting at. So our words impact us. They allow us to change our beliefs, and how we operate, how we operate in our lives. Look at operas. Operas, Italian versus German operas. They are so much different in the way they look. You could tell, even if you know nothing about opera, you can't name one opera in the world. You can point, and let's say your ears are closed, you can't hear the music. Someone will say there's a German opera and there's an Italian opera. 9 out of 10 times, you could point and say, that's Italian, that's German. Why? Because the tone of the language. German is a strong language. Flucht, flucht. That affects the way people are moving and operating and climbing and singing and opening their arms. Italian is a beautiful, soft language. That being the case, it's going to affect the way the actors sing, the way the actors move, the way the set is decorated. And you could tell because the words, again, the way we speak and the way we use our words are so significant. Most of our social relationships that are significant ones are just based on the way we use our words. They're solely based on the way we use our words. Some people may be avoiding you, and you have to take note of your words. Are my words always sarcastic? For a while, it's funny. After a while, people feel like you're not the person I want on a rainy day. You could tell a lot why somebody's distancing themselves from you by looking at the way you speak, your speech patterns, the words you use over and over. Look at the people who are positive. Not positive, crazy positive, but realistic positive. You're the type of person that attracts people around you because those are the words that are empowering, that people need to hear in their lives. So your words can create massive change. When you're working somewhere, you're the type of person that's giving the people around you praise. You're the one everybody wants around. If you're a person who's a Debbie Downer every single day at your job, at what you're doing, it impacts the whole office around you. If any of you are going to be managers, God, maybe some of you are entrepreneurs already. Not too late, Mark. Not too early. Mark Zuckerberg started at this point. If you are entrepreneurs at this point, look at how you operate with the people around you. Notice how you speak to them. The words you use can change the way they function. Imagine that. You could speak in a certain way, and the partner that you're going into business with could be for you, or he could be amazing for you. And that's all based on how you speak to that person. You say, you know, Phil, what you just did, that's creative, that's cutting edge, that's brilliant. Phil now believes that. And because of that, Phil will seek other ways to be cutting edge and brilliant. Instead, you turn to Phil and say, Phil, you know, again, you you suck at what you do. That affects him. And because of that, low self-esteem. You could impact everybody around you. Imagine that. Not even actions, just words. How you impact the people around you. That's Judaism's emphasis on the concept of Lashon Hara, speaking badly of other people. The damage it does. And people are scarred. People sit in therapy for 25 years because of something. One line their father said to them. One line at the wrong time their father said to them at some point in their lives, and they're working on it for years. They're playing that over and over in their heads because of that line. It's always replaying. The power of your words. So you want to alter your beliefs, you look at three ways. Your physiology, your movement, your focus, and your language. So that's the way you wake up. You wake up, you jump out of bed, you down that freezing cold glass of water, you scream in the mirror, jump around, get excited. Number two, you also choose to focus on the things you want to conquer that day. And number three, you psych yourself up by talking to yourself in that mirror. Give yourself that message that you need to hear. That works for you. It can't be a crazy message that doesn't apply. You can't say, I'm an Iron Man, I'm the strongest man around, when you know you're weak. Make it realistic, but positive. Talk yourself into the things you want to get done that day. Okay, those are three things. Okay, what I'm going to share with you now, we have 11 minutes left. I'm going to give you a key right now that if you use it wisely, I am guaranteeing you a total shift in the rest of your lives. Okay, I'm making that bold statement right here today, 2010. December 23rd, what are we?
Yeah.
December 23rd, okay? If you use this, this is game-changing for whoever you will date, whoever you will marry, the kids you will eventually raise, the people you will work with, and the professors you need to manipulate. This will change everything, okay? We all operate based on 6 values. Now, Maslow has had his hierarchy of values, and then everybody since Maslow and their cousin has come up with values by which humans move, which move us. It seems to me, from just talking to a lot of people and working with people, that these are, for at least for now, the 6 values by which all of us operate. And if you could pinpoint Which on the list of six is the person you're dealing with, their primary value that they operate with, you understand them. You got them. Because once you know their value, you know what it is that makes them tick. Once you know what it is that makes them tick, in a negative way, you can manipulate the heck out of them. But in a positive way, you know how to be there for them. You know how to be a friend to that person. You know how to be good to that person. And forget anybody else. Once you realize what your hierarchy of values are in these six, you understand why you've been doing the things you've been doing. And if you want to change them, you can, because now you understand it. So here are the six values, and I'll tell you how to operate this in the best way possible. Number one, certainty. The first value is certainty. That means we want certain consistency in our lives. We want to know, many of us, that when we get home, our same bed is going to be there. Nobody moved our stuff around. Certainty. We want to know that when we wake up, we know where we're waking up. Certainty. We want to know that when we talk to our parents or friends, we want to know the conversation is going to go the way it nicely always goes. We, all of us on some level, crave certainty. Number two, which is the opposite of that. Besides the certainty, we want variation. Variation. While we may crave certainty and stability, at the same time, we need multiple flavors. We need to change it up. Restaurants, clubs, things we go to, classes we hear, whatever it is we're doing. Many of us need variety. We all need, but on some level, we all need variety in our lives. The people we hang out with, we need some color to it. We need variety. And both of those, by the way, are values and can be values. You look in Judaism, Judaism has this, you know, strong suggestion towards establishing set times when you're going to study something. It's called Koveya Itim L'Torah. Make set times, set and certain times that you don't miss when you sit down with the Bible in front of you. That's certainty. On the other hand, there's an emphasis as well on variety, that even within our set prayers, we could always stick in a little something at the end of it to change it up, to make it personal, to make it come from the heart, to keep it more flavorful. The variety, the way the holidays change and the way their color is. No two holidays are the same. Passover is totally different than Purim. Purim is totally different than Yom Kippur. There's tremendous color variety. Look at the tribes. The classic tribes of Judaism, they all have their unique flag, their unique identity, and they're all there with a unique personality. So we, on the one hand, crave stability. On the other hand, we crave variety. Number three, significance. All of us in some way want significance. Whether to be a legend at whatever we're doing, or whether the opposite side, for people to see us as the one who suffers the most. Some people achieve significance in their lives by always complaining about how bad they have it. I'm significant because I am the one who struggles the most in this group. We all seek significance. You have significance as an important value. This is a wild passage in the Talmud. I'll keep it on. I'll keep the recorder on. This guy who talks about a certain guy who used to love going around to different prostitutes. And he's going around, and he's going from city to city to city to city. Okay, he's going off through his checklist. He's heard there's one over there in Paraguay, checklist. Next one over here, check, check, check. He's going everyone. He hears there's one out in the islands, far away out in Jamaica. Okay, and the Talmud says how he crossed seven islands to get to her. He gets to her, and while he's there with her, what happens, there's two variations of this section in the Talmud. What happens while he's there with her, he breaks wind while he's with her. Okay, that's what happens. And she turns to him and says, this is where she disses him. She says, just like that wind ain't going back to where it came from, you are not going back to where you came from. Okay, you know things are bad when even the prostitute's knocking you. And he all of a sudden turns and he breaks down and he says, oh my gosh, I got to change my life. I need a breakthrough. So all of a sudden he runs out of her house and he realizes what a low life he's been, what the way he's led his life in such a disgusting way. He runs out and he prays and he says to the stars in the skies, pray for me, stars in the skies. The stars in the skies say, we have our own issues to deal with. We can't help you. He goes to the trees and the surrounding, you know, the nature, and says, pray for me, trees and bushes. And they say, hey, kid, we got our own issues. Pray for yourself. Then he goes to the mountains and says, pray for me, please, pray for me. And they say, we have our own issues. You know, his name was Elazar. Elazar, you pray. It's on you, man. We got too many things to do. At that point, the Talmud says he realized, Ein hadavar taloi elabi. It's only up to me. I am the agent of change. I am the one who is most significant in my life who could make that change. He lets out the most tremendous cry in history, says the Talmud. And at that moment, he dies from the anguish, from the pain at the end of the story. He dies from the anguish. And the rabbis mention how some people are able to achieve greatness in one moment. That realization that it's all dependent, change is dependent on me. And if you think about what the Talmud just said, it's amazing. Because look at that, he went to the stars, he went to nature, right? He went to the trees and the bushes. What does that mean? That's all of us. We base our behaviors, we say, oh, it's our environment, it's not our fault, it's our environment's fault. And the nature was saying, don't pin it on us. He went to the mountains. Who are the mountains? Traditionally in Judaism, the mountains are our parents. It's my parents' fault. They did this to me. They gave me issues. I didn't even get to go. I didn't have the money to go to Hoffman. They made me crazy. No, don't pin it on us. You have choice. And then he went to the stars in the sky, right? He went to the stars, the cosmos. It's in my DNA. It's been written in the stars. It's my destiny. There's nothing I could do about it. Don't pin it on us. Ein hadavar tali elabi. You want to make change? It's all on you. You are the agent of change. Don't. All these things influence us. There's no doubt. But at the end of the day, we can make the choices one way or the other. And that's significance on a positive level. It's a third value. Number four, connection or love. We all seek connection or love in our lives. We all need it. We crave it. There's no one who could live on an island. We all, well, actually, I saw on, I don't know what it was. It was some video on the internet of a family that lives the farthest from civilization in the world. They're out in the deepest corner of Alaska. They are the single farthest family from any other family anywhere. It's this husband and wife who's been living there. And if God forbid something happens to one of them, it's like there's no way out. There's nothing for another, 6-7 hours away. They raised kids over there. The kids went off to college. It's wild. I mean, you look up Alaska people who live in the middle of nowhere, something like that. fine. So we all crave love and connection on some level. Number five. These are the two ones that I think are most bonus on the list because they're the ones that most people tend to devalue, but they may be the most significant. Number five is contribution. We all need to contribute in some way. Yes?
What was number four?
Number four, put connection or love. Five is contribution, okay? Contribution. We need to contribute in some way, whether to a charity, whether to a project. We need to contribute. And number six is growth. You can't stay the same person at all times. The great rabbi, the Vilna Gaon, said, either you're moving up, or you're moving down. There ain't no staying in the same place. You think you're in the same place, but you find out, let's say you're that guy who just was that, you were that huge jock that everybody loved because you were the jock. And you stayed that way, right? 10 years later, if you're still that way, you've moved because now you ain't the great jock anymore. Everybody else has moved on. It's like being on a subway. You'll be on a subway here. You think you're standing in one place. By the time you get out, you find you're in a totally different place. You're always moving. We choose which direction. So we need growth. Now that you have these six values, you can take anybody, any relationship problem, and you can understand it totally by looking at these values. For example, you find that your girlfriend's being tough on you. Everything is always, she needs it to be this way, needs it to be that way. Well, you know what that tells you? What's number one on her list from the six values? Number one on her list from the six values is certainty. She, for some reason in her life, has a need to feel that things are going to be stable and certain. So she controls it by telling you to do X, Y, and Z. And here's the clincher to this whole piece. We each live out these values by putting them in a hierarchy, but we choose to live them out either in an empowering way or in a disempowering way. A disempowering way for certainty is by trying to control every single person around us. That's a disempowering way to live the value of certainty. An empowering way to live the value of certainty is to have a certain drink that we love starting our morning with that makes us, smile, whatever, even if that's a cup of water, a cup of orange juice, or we have a certain prayer that we always start with, a meditation that we always start with. Those are empowering certainties in our life. So each of these have a empowering or disempowering connection and love. Take the guy in the story from the Talmud. The way he sought connection in his life was by going to places he shouldn't be. That's the way he was looking for connection. How he got that in his head that that's connection? Dig Freudian and dig deep into his past. Who knows? But the point is, that's how he understood, and that's the way he was choosing to live a life of connection and love. So you ask yourself, forget about other people right now, look at yourself and ask, what are the six needs? How do I rank these in my life? Once I know that, ask yourself, do I live each one in an empowering way or a disempowering way? And not only that, rank how you live that on a scale of 1 to 10. If you know you live a certain value at a 10, it's going to be very intense. If you're at a 10 uncertainty, very difficult in a relationship. Watch out for those people who want 10 of who need 10 certainty in their relationships. Those are massively controlling people, and it's very, very tough. Very tough. It's okay to put certainty at the top, but not at a 10, my friends. You gotta find a way to wean yourself off that 10 by finding more empowering values to replace them with. So I think that's a great key. This will help you work with anybody, anybody you're around. If you know a boss places one of the values at the top, you know what are the words they need to hear to feel safe and happy with you, because you know what their value is. You know what they appreciate. This is so significant, knowing what these values are going to be. Let's close. So much more to say, but I want to close with the following. We're talking about making changes. We're talking about making a breakthrough, making a difference in your lives, knowing that you can do it right now, looking at your beliefs, looking at your values, and from there moving forward, the way you speak, the way you talk, the way you move, the way you operate. About 15 years ago when I was in L.A., I found out that in a house near where I was going to be, it was right before the Sabbath, I found that there was this famous mystical Hasidic Rebbe who tells you about, you know, what's going on in your life, and he could look into your eyes and just tell you, you know, really what's going on with you. So I'm, you know, skeptical of that stuff by my nature, but I said, you know what, I hear he's a very holy guy, I'd love to meet him. I went over to see him, and just a beautiful-looking personality. Beautiful-looking personality. I remember the contrast of the beautiful white outfit he had on and the blue skies hovering over him, the L.A. blue skies on a non-smoggy day, you know, hovering over him. And I shook his hand, and then he froze. Like, you ever see the Dead Zone, the show The Dead Zone? He, like, froze, and then I'm like, oh, man, he's just stopped. I'm like, he knows about what I did to the teacher's car. I'm like, he's for sure thinking about everything right now. I'm finished. And then all of a sudden, he opened his mouth, and he said the following, and it was just... it was what I needed to hear right at that time. Moses stands at the burning bush, and God tells him the following words, and this comes into play with how Hebrew is so valuable. Shal na lecha me'al raglecha ki amakom asher ata omed alav ad mas kodeshu. Remove the shoes from your feet, because the place where you stand, Moses, is holy ground. It's the famous interlude of Moses and the burning bush. Remove the shoes from your feet, because where you stand is holy ground. So he quoted me that verse, great, beautiful, that's fine. And he said, you know how you read it? He says, in Hebrew, na'alecha is not only shoes. A na'al in Hebrew, li'ol et adelet, a na'al is a lock. Remove the shackles from your feet. If you realize that wherever you stand, ka'asher ata omer alav, wherever you stand in life is holy ground, nothing can hold you back. What an empowering idea that wherever you stand in life, holiness in Judaism is not just about the times we're in synagogue. It's not a religion that is reserved for the times in a study hall. It is wherever we stand in life, we have the ability to free ourselves, to unleash the power that's in each and every one of us, to have that amazing breakthrough that we all deserve. I hope y'all enjoy the rest of your time here. And it was really, I thank you for the opportunity of doing that.